The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 249.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. She is one of my good buddies from Phoenix, Arizona. She is one of my favorite people in this space. That is for sure. Her name is Lynette Zhang. Lynette, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Well, you know, George, I'm really happy to be here because you too are one of my favorite people in this space. Out of this space.
Well, and I need to mention that she is going to be one of our headlining speakers at Rebel Capitalist Live, which unfortunately we're sold out right now. But those of you who did get your ticket, you're going to be able to see Lynette face to face and listen to her amazing presentation. And probably one of the things that you might be talking about, Lynette, is this deal that's going on with the banks and them starting to issue or talk about issuing credit cards to people who have absolutely no credit history.
Let's keep this going.
This is just the greatest thing ever, and it's going to reduce inequality. It's going to eradicate poverty. If only every single American had a credit card and could go out and consume more than they produce, well, all problems would be solved, right?
I definitely think so. I mean, that's certainly the policy that I have followed. Not at all. I mean, the insanity continues, doesn't it?
Why do you think they're doing that?
Just to try and keep the game going, because when people get that don't know how to manage their money to begin with, have no credit history, and they get the credit cards, then they feel like they're rich. They're going to go out and spend, and that will stimulate the economy. That's right. Exactly why they're doing it, to keep, and they've been, you know, I mean, this is the latest piece of that, but you look at the Experian boost your credit rating, boost this. I mean, they've been really reducing the requirements to get credit, but isn't that kind of what they did in the lead up to the housing crisis? Mm. Go ahead, get as much house as you can afford on this variable rate, because you can always refinance. And then who ended up eating it?
And let's ignore your credit rating. Let's ignore your credit
score.
Your
ability to pay.
Exactly. And the same thing that they're doing with credit cards.
Exactly.
Do you think it has something to do with them trying to create inflation? And what I mean by that is, if you look back at the way dollars are typically created, it's through the banking system, the commercial banking system, creating more loans. So if they lend you $500,000 to buy a house, that was $500,000 currency units that did not exist prior to that, that are in the economy chasing goods and services. And since the pandemic, we have seen consumer bank lending go down quite dramatically, right, even though housing prices are going up. And so in the mind of a Keynesian central planner, they're like, okay, well, right now we're just staying afloat because of all the additional government spending and the Fed monetizing the debt. But that's because the Fed's monetizing it, and that's creating more dollars in the real economy. Okay, great, but we can't depend on that. And we really can't depend on the commercial banking system. But the one entity that we can depend on is the consumer. And if they're getting credit cards, then that's creating additional loans and therefore creating additional dollars, additional purchasing power. Do you think that might be a roundabout way to try to stoke inflation, to bail out the government?
Well, I don't know quite how that bails out the government.
Well, because there's such a huge debtor. You know, so if they get inflation, then technically they're paying back their debt with cheaper dollars.
Right. Although I really think the Fed is doing one heck of a good job with that. So it is. I don't know how much more help they need to create all those dollars. But I think it does could also, yes, go along with that. as well as the UBI. I mean, it is getting people to spend, and it's more dollars chasing a finite number of goods. And that definitely will bring in the hyperinflation that they need to repay this debt with dollars that have zero value. So yeah, that certainly could be one of the ways. But, you know, we've been hearing about this, you know, we want everybody to participate in the financial system. I mean, and even giving credit cards and debit cards to young kids so that they can learn how to, I don't know, manage. So, yeah, I think the expansion of the credit is about getting the consumer to consume. I think it's all about getting the consumer to consume.
Yeah, it's just a debt-based monetary system. And if they want the monetary side of the equation to grow, they got to get the debt side of the equation to grow as well.
But you know, here's the thing with that, right? We know, they know that we're at the end of this whole cycle. So it's kind of like, if you know you're declaring bankruptcy anyway, and you get a credit card in the mail, the most likely outcome is that you're going to go spend that money.
Right.
Right. Now, you kind of wonder whose benefit that's for, but we've already been shown that the banks will be bailed out. And this morning, when they were talking, the banks were in front of the House Senate Committee on Banking, and they talked about the fact that the loans were down. I mean, it was pretty interesting to listen to all these banks tout how good they're doing with extending credit to, you know, small businesses and those in the minorities, et cetera, et cetera. And then hear that ripped apart. But you're absolutely right. The loans are going down as they're taking in and holding a whole lot more savings. And the savings rate, I think, is up to like 27.3% right now, which shows loss of confidence.
Yeah. And incomes are up because of the government transfer payments. I read a statistic the other day I've used in some of my whiteboard videos that the average income in the United States went up by over 20% just in March of 2021 compared to the month prior. I mean, these are staggering increases in the level of income with less productivity. We're increasing incomes, but we're decreasing the amount of goods and services that are available to us.
I just had recently checked the monetary velocity chart to see if that had started going up, and it's down again. So even with all of this new income and all of this shopping, I mean, you have to watch it because it's a lagging indicator, but that's when I think we're going to really see when we see it go up in a pervasive way, and that's what they're pushing to do. So with the credit cards, I think it's more about spending and stimulus and yes, generating that inflation, but not necessarily about creating new dollars, though you're absolutely right. It does. That's how money's created in the system. But I think it's more about spending.
Yeah, right. And I think that it's weird because that velocity number is a component of nominal GDP. And so if nominal GDP is staying the same, but yet the M2 money supply is increasing, then velocity is going to go down. It just makes you wonder if the prices are actually going up, but we're just selling or buying less stuff. I mean, one of the things I've been talking about, one of the experiences that I've had personally here in Florida and other areas is like going out to a restaurant. This is an example I always use. You know, you can't get a reservation anywhere. I mean, even when I was in Phoenix and we were there hanging out, you know, going to the Capitol Grill there at the Biltmore or City Hall, or any of those restaurants down in Old Town. I mean, in fact, when we went out to sushi, that was pretty much the only place that I could find where we could even get a reservation. Every place is just absolutely booked. And you sit there and scratch your head and like, wait a minute, my portfolio might be bigger today than it was in 2019, but I have access to fewer goods and services. And have you experienced anything like that in your own life as far as a shortage of something that you can't or are having a hard time getting now that you could have got very easily in 2019?
Well, I'm kind of self-sufficient.
Yeah, I didn't really think that one through.
Sorry about that. So I don't really go you know, out to eat all that often. In fact, I think, I think I might have gone out one time since we went out that night.
Yeah.
But I am noticing a huge increase in price. Actually, no, I'm sorry, I'm not good at that because I'm really too self-sufficient.
Yeah. And I might add for those viewing and listening right now that I am maybe one of the only people that have done shots of sake with Lynette Zhang. That's right. We were doing shots of sake at the sushi restaurant.
That's true. Everybody thought it was just this like squeaky clean. Now you reveal the fact that I actually did shots of tequila with you. That's right. I did.
Yeah. Is it tequila or sake?
No, it was sake. It was sake.
Was it sake? Okay. Yeah, we'll have to do it again at Rebel Capitalist Live. Okay. So let's talk about that because that's one of the things that I had on my list is, and the people who watch your channel, I think understand this, but I don't know if you've ever done any behind the scenes stuff, but for my viewers, they, oh yeah, I know Lynette. I've watched a few of her videos on gold or the reset or any of these things, but I don't think they truly understand how you live your life. And I think it's very important in today's day and age that people understand that. I was just part of this documentary called The End Game, where yes, they talk about finances and economics, but they also talk about how in the future, we're most likely going to see greater amounts of civil unrest and definitely see more government overreach, especially, you know, looking at what we've seen in 2020, 2021. And you're a perfect example of how to kind of unplug from the system and therefore have more of your personal liberty in your own control. Exactly. So can you explain how you live and then what you're doing in the future to even create a greater distance and therefore more personal liberty?
Yeah, and this is actually something that I want to talk about more in more depth, you know, at your event. But, you know, you follow my mantra: food, water, energy security, barterability, wealth preservation, community, and shelter. Mm-hmm. And so really, I've been working on that on some level for quite some time. But in 2010, that's when I was getting ready to retire, actually. And I was living in a little two-bedroom condo, which I could easily just lock up and go my merry way and go explore the world. And then, of course, 2008 happened, because I did not think I would see a currency regime shift in my lifetime, actually. But even though I knew that we were near endgame, that kind of changed everything for me. Mm-hmm. And so I turned around, bought this property, half an acre. I would have gone out, but my children wouldn't, and I would never leave them. So I decided that I needed to kind of make my last stand right where I was. And I bought a half an acre property that I could grow food on. And that was the first thing I did, was right after I bought that property, I went outside and I started building my beds. I was not a gardener. I was not a farmer. That was nothing. I mean, if I felt like digging in the dirt, I'd go visit a sister and we'd go dig in her dirt. But I know that food is the single biggest issue for people during hyperinflationary and currency regime shifts. Mm. So initially it was about preparing for my family. But George, you've been there, right? I don't really know how to do things in a small way. And
yeah, so, I was just going to say, when you say that you wanted to grow your own food, what most people think of is probably just a couple chickens in the back and maybe a little garden. I know that's what I was thinking prior to actually going there and seeing the whole spread. But it trust me, whatever you're imagining right now as the viewer or the listener, you have no idea. Times it by about 1,000 and then you're kind of getting close. I think it would be easier to list the things that you don't grow as opposed to things that you do grow. I mean, everything from almonds to artichokes to pomegranates to your own tilapia pond to herbs to geese to chickens to doves to, I mean, it's like a Whole Foods right there in your backyard.
Actually, it is. And, you know, when I mean, I've appreciated it ever since, but I particularly appreciated it when the pandemic first hit and, you know, you couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't, the grocery store shelves were bare. Yeah. And I'm walking out of my gardens and, you know, I was able to help people because of what I did, you know, and all of the setup. So, and also medicinal plants, because it's food and then it's medicine. And of course, I don't really use a lot of medicine, but if I have medicinal herbs, everything is like a superfood. So, you know, the goal for me is to have the ability to feed as many people as possible on just my little half acre. It's not very big, but, you know, and then I did it in layers, right? So I would say, okay, of those, of my mantra pieces, where do I feel most vulnerable? And then I would go in, and if it was security, there was a back door where anybody could have frankly just walked in, pushed it open pretty easy because it's an old house. So that was, well, I think the first thing I did about security was put in that security door. So I think everybody really needs to be as independent and self-sufficient as possible, right, and creating their own little community. I think we have one of the consultants with a couple of his friends are coming out to the farm. They scheduled it, I don't know exactly when, to help. And then of course they get to harvest, they get to take home. My neighbors get to come in and they get to harvest. They don't get to leave me with nothing, but there's plenty. So, you know, I think it's critically important. You need the silver for barterability. You need the gold for both wealth preservation as well as opportunity positioning. But you cannot eat silver and gold. So you need that food and you need the medicine and you need the security, especially when there is unrest in the streets. And what I found, the hole in my strategy, was that I didn't have a place to flee to and bring my family to if it got really, really bad and I felt unsafe. And that really was when they were having the protests. Right. Near my house, and actually even near my children's house, and they don't live very close to me. I mean, they live in Scottsdale, I live in Central Phoenix. And so that I got buttoned up, but unfortunately it took a long time to get it buttoned up and find the right place. Yeah,
but tell the story there. So what did you do to solve that problem?
I went out and I started looking at remote places with enough property. I wanted it to at least have a well and have the ability to take it 100% off grid. Fortunately, an architect had that vision as well. And so the property that I ended up buying, it has solar, it has wind energy, it has a generator, it has a well, it has two huge rain catchments with a filtration system. So it is 100%, and it's very remote. It's very, yeah, right, very remote.
Yeah.
I mean, we've popped Kevlar tires going up there and back. So tires are really important to me right now. We're actually been talking about opening up a tire shop because every time we go, we seem to pop a tire. It is very, very remote. And that's what I did. I feel so safe up there because I don't think it's not visible from anywhere. And it's large enough with some air mattresses, but it's large enough for my whole family.
Just quite a few people. So right, if we went through, I mean, even obviously the probability is probably very low, but the United States goes through some sort of hyperinflationary event or some event, who knows, with the way that the social unrest and the divisiveness is going. I mean, you look at civil war, and I hate to use that term lightly, but I'm doing so because I just saw an interview with Neil Howe, who is the author of The Fourth Turning. This is an interview, yes, on Real Vision. And Ed Harrison, who's a great interviewer, asked Neil, he said, you know, this political divisiveness that we see right now, or not just in politics, but absolutely everything, it's, yes, been exacerbated by everyone having to wear masks. And now you can tell, you know, someone's political position just by kind of how they're dressed or what they're wearing over their face. He said, have you ever seen anything like this in your life or have you throughout your research, right? Have you ever seen it? He said, yeah. He goes, if you look back through American history, twice we were at this level. Number one, the American Revolution. And number mm-hmm. two, just prior to the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I don't want to be hyperbolic and use that term, but the fact of the matter is we've only been this divisive as a society twice before, and kind of it's ended up with, let's say, conflict. And so, yeah. You know, regardless of whether we have that hyperinflationary event or XYZ conflict, you know, I know this property, your family is going to be, they're going to be taken care of. And yes. I think that people really need to start, you know, not losing sleep over this, but at least having a plan B.
You've got to have a plan. You have absolutely got to have a plan. And I mean, frankly, planning is, and helping people create that plan is a lot of what we do here at ITM,
yeah.
because it isn't just about owning gold and silver. It's about being able to sustain a reasonable standard of living for yourself, for your family. I mean, I personally see no way around either hyperinflationary, hyperdeflationary. I mean, it's basically the same thing in my opinion. There's too much insanity out there, admitted insanity, and there is a large loss of confidence that's happening. I think that's what, going back to the credit cards, you know, taking that whole loop and universal basic income and all of that. This is really a think about quieting the masses, you know, and that's the way they do it. They throw breadcrumbs to the masses, it's more than what they had before. So the masses are going, oh, okay, this is not so bad, but I don't think it's going to work this time because it's too big a shift.
And it's so ironic that if you listen to their narrative, it's, well, we need to reduce the wealth gap and we need equality. But the way they're going about it is to reduce the wealth gap, create equality by giving people credit cards. With a 400% interest rate.
You know, actually at that Senate meeting, when they were talking about it, they actually came out when, I don't remember who asked this question, but to justify the average income of these bank CEOs to their workers is 900 times one. So it's hard for them to imagine, you know, so they asked, how can you justify that? And they all just said, well, it's the board's choice. So they played it off. And then they also asked if they would accept unions at the banks, if they would support a union coming into the bank. And they all said no. Then now the speaker, whoever asked the question, said, this is a yes or no question. Made it real simple. Would you support that? Would you accept that? Well, there was only one person, Jamie Dimon, that actually came out with that one word reply, which was no. Everybody else talked around it. So in essence, what they said was no. So you're talking about closing that gap, but you're not talking about enabling the workers to have more say. And we've been watching since the 50s, we've been watching unions enrollment go down, 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 down. And I can remember, my father was a developer in New York. And I remember when the union wanted to come into his property and he paid enough and gave enough benefits that the workers decided not to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm seeing the banks do, saying, well, we now have minimum wage at $20 an hour and it's going up to $25 an hour by 2025. But even $20 an hour is not a living wage with the prices of housing and food and insurance and education and all of those costs. It's still not a living wage. So,
or it might not be an acceptable wage when the government is paying you $30 an hour to stay home and not do anything.
You know, I mean, is it really, is that what it works out to, George? I never did the calculations.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to imply that that's the actual number. I'm just saying from a conceptual standpoint, you know, if the government, now these industries and these entrepreneurs, these businesses are having to compete with the government for those workers, which I'm not saying is right or wrong. What I am saying is that the central planning is further distorting
Absolutely.
An already distorted free market, if you want to even call it that.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't want to call it a free market.
Yeah.
I don't want to call it a capitalist market because it's neither a free market, nor is it a pure capitalist market. It's definitely a crony capitalist market.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I feel like we're definitely living, you know, I hate to say this because I really would like to believe that we're living in a democracy, but I think this is definitely more of a fascist state than a democracy. Because
yeah.
the corporations are clearly more important than the individuals.
Yeah, and they're in bed with the politicians. And that's kind of, from an economic standpoint, that's kind of how you define fascism. So if someone is listening to this right now and saying, okay, I get what Lynette is saying, and I like her principles, but if I'm starting from scratch, and I'm someone that's making $50,000 or $75,000 a year, you know, they might not be able to buy a bug out place that's 75 miles into Nowheresville on solar right. and a well and all these things.
Right.
What steps can they take using your seven principles? To really make sure that, or do the best that they can to ensure there's family as they're preserving wealth and they're preserving their liberties and freedom and they're creating a sustainable future for their family, regardless of what's happening around them.
Exactly. And I think what you have to do is look at where your biggest holes are. And, you know, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Mm-hmm. So you look at what your circumstances are and what you have to work with. Food is something that's actually fairly easy, whether you're living in an apartment and you have no outdoor space to grow, or you have lots of acreage. It's going to be different depending upon where you are. But, you know, it really does not cost very much to buy some sprouting seeds and throw them in your freezer, a few pounds of sprouting seeds, so that you always have live food, or some bags of rice and beans that will hold for a long period of time. So, you know, there are definitely things that you can do. Also, you know, you want it. So it's the food and then the water. There are easy catchment systems that you can make if you live in an area where you do get a lot of rain, like in Florida. You know, there's a lot of rain there. In Arizona, there's not so much. But still, there are catchment systems that you can put up and let nature provide that for you. Or go out and dig a pond. I mean, that's what I did. I dug ponds on my property. And you only have to go down like 3 feet and you just put in a good filtration system. It's not very expensive. There's lots of how-tos on YouTube, and we're doing some things to help people learn how to do that. So I would basically say what you need to do is you need to write the mantra down and then say, okay, where do I feel the most pain? I mean, you know, silver is not very expensive. You can start to accumulate a little bit and do it sooner than later. And keep in mind, I mean, I think this is critical that people don't necessarily think about, but gold and silver in any form is monetary at its base. So like when the coin dealers were having a hard time getting silver, well, guess what? Go to an antique shop. And I've even had people, antique dealers, comment on that. Go to like an antique mall, find out who deals in most of the silver there and ask them if they'll sell you their scrap. The stuff that's broken and bent that they can't sell, they can't put out in the showcases, they'll probably let you have it at spot because that's more than they would get if they took it to a smelter.
Right.
So the same thing with gold. I mean, knowing this, I accumulate a lot of that stuff over the years. Not so easy to find anymore, but you know, I'd go to yard sales, estate sales, Salvation Army, so secondhand stores, all of that. And people don't realize what they have and they just think that it's junk or I don't want to polish it. So you have to look at where you are the most vulnerable and then start to plug those holes in. We are putting together, it's not quite done yet, but we are putting together like a minimum. So if you take the mantra, this is what you would need at a minimum level. So if you are really strapped for cash, okay, well, try to work toward this. If you're more affluent, you can do that. And there are also a lot of properties. Well, I don't know, because we've had this massive real estate boom, but there are properties that you can buy and maybe they need more work. You know, I was really lucky because, you know, I managed to find this property and I do need to put in a food source, but that's it. That's all I need to put in. So we've started plans to put in a hot house to create food. And in the meantime, you know, I'm doing my buckets of rice and legumes, and now I've got a complete program protein. So we are putting together a minimum thing, but it's not, you don't have to have $1 million to protect your family. You don't.
Yeah, you need one of like those Dave Ramsey. What does he have? Like, what's his program called? The financial peace program or something like that. Yeah, that's what Lynette Zhang needs for not only financial peace, but peace of mind when peace it comes to, to taking care of your family and freedom.
Exactly. And freedom. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about. That's what it's all about. Because when you are a debt slave, which is really what they want everybody to be, then you have to dance to their tune, whether you like it or not. You don't have any choice. So if everything you have remains in their system, then it's easy to control. And if those that are currently in power that helped get us into this extreme mess, you know, income inequality, I don't care what they say, income and wealth inequality was built into the very system, the fiat system that they created,
right?
Because inflation was built into it.
Right.
And who suffers the most from that?
That's right.
You know, so for them to talk about fighting it, the only reason why they're talking about fighting it is to avoid the revolution. Right. So I think that's more with the credit cards and giving people that really can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was interesting too, because they asked Jamie Dimon about the overdraft fees. And because of course all the banks came out and said what great jobs they were doing for those that were suffering from the COVID crisis. And he said, well, if they asked if they would reverse those fees, because it was some enormous amount of money, something like, don't hold me to this because I don't really remember the exact number, but something like $2.4 billion worth of overdraft fees that Chase collected in 2020.
Yeah.
Right. And when asked if they would reverse those fees and give all those people back those money or extend them in loans or do something to help the community, there was his one word answer: no.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
You know, I want to make sure there's enough blame on the Fed for that, though. I mean, I definitely want to call a spade with the banksters. And I don't want to let them off the hook. But the Fed has kept interest rates artificially low. They've flattened out the yield curve. And as you know, the banksters, they're making money if that yield curve is steep. Now, we've seen it steepen lately. But when you've got like a decade of a super flat yield curve, the banksters can't really make that much money through retail lending. So what do you see happen? Well, now they got to make it some way. So then you see the overdraft fees increase. You see credit card fees increase. They're going to get their money some way.
Somewhere.
It's not coming from the yield curve.
And derivative trading. Come on. I mean, they make more money from derivative trading, speculative derivative trading. And what do you think? I'm curious your opinion on this with them recently changing the rules to classify savings accounts and money market accounts now as demand deposit accounts, because it puts it in a completely different classification.
Yeah, I'm not sure why
would
they
change that.
I don't know. But the one thing that I can tell you is that if you're one comment that I've been getting a lot on my live streams lately is how the reverse repos done with the Fed have just gone through the roof. I mean, the chart's completely, literally parabolic. And I think they're doing up to like $300 or $400 billion. I believe it's a day in reverse repo. I don't know what it's been lately, but I think this was last week. And, you know, people say, well, is this another crack in the system? And I don't know that it's a crack in the system, but it does play into what you're talking about. So for people to understand, a reverse repo is when a commercial bank, they're going to give the cash to the Fed, who already has the cash on their balance sheet, but then they're going to take those treasuries. And so why would they want that? Well, it kind of implies that there's either too much cash, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me, or there's not enough treasuries. There's not enough collateral in the system. And so these banks, commercial banks, want those treasuries because they can rehypothecate those treasuries. They can turn them. They can use them to create these derivatives that you're talking about to make a 5 or 6 or 7% return. So even if they have to pay or do whatever they need to do to get those treasuries, even if the treasuries have a negative real yield, it doesn't matter because they're making it up with the derivatives market, which goes back to them going further out the risk curve. And the reason they're doing, or one of the main reasons, is because those interest rates are so low that they can't really make any money with commercial lending unless they can flip the paper directly to the Fed. So it all comes full circle.
And it does come full circle. And when you talk about too much liquidity, well, there's a tremendous amount of liquidity that the Fed has created in the system at the same time that they're creating it and buying up those short-term treasuries that then go into that, the repo and the reverse repo.
Yeah, that they just borrow right back from the Fed.
Yeah, it's just this, exactly. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's just insane. You can't make this stuff up. Can't they keep doing this forever? Well, no. When you see things going parabolic, it's because they're panicking and the system that they created and all the convolutions are no longer working. Yeah, and they're starting to fall apart. And that's really been true. Well, it's been true for a long time, but very, very true since September 2019.
Right.
They haven't fixed anything. Mm-hmm. They haven't changed behavior. They've maybe moved it off balance sheet, or they've moved it obviously outside of the banking system. Because 2008, it was all a lot of stuff that was, and all of the bad loans that were held in the banking system. And so that created the problem. But what they did is they moved it into shadow banks, and which do a lot of the same things as banks, but they don't have the deposits that the banks have. They don't take in the deposits, but the banks loan to the hedge funds and the shadow banks that risk has transferred to, and it's more opaque. That's what they've been talking about. The Fed has been talking about how, like Archegos, you know, that whole, we have not seen the end of the derivative eruption there yet. We haven't seen the end of it. Just because they're not talking about it anymore doesn't mean that it's fixed. It's more about us thinking or not thinking about it. It's that short-termism that they've been pushing us for. Yeah. But I still believe without a doubt that it will be the derivatives that end up creating a crisis that will send us into the reset.
It's like pretending a tsunami doesn't exist because you can't see it under the water. You know, you just gotta, it's there, trust me. You'll know it's there once it gets a little closer to the shore. Why do people need, why does person X need a different strategy with their precious metals than person Y?
Well, because for example, I mean, we all have different goals. For me, my goal is to create dynastic wealth that I can pass on to my children and my grandchildren because I want them to have choices. Hmm. But number one, not everybody has children, right? So they would not need to do what I'm doing for myself personally. So that's why all of the strategies are really customized. And the first thing that has to take place is you need to have a conversation and define what are your goals? What are you trying to accomplish? Right. And then it's the right tool for the job. So that's why we all are, you know, you're in a different circumstance than I am. You're going to have different goals than I do. You're going to have different means to work with than I do. So yeah, it all has to be, all the strategies basically at the base, it's the same. Mm-hmm. It's what goes on top of it, those nuances that right. really need to be customized to you, your circumstances and your goals versus me, my circumstances and goals.
Right. And that's, we'll just go ahead and plug your company. That's exactly what you guys do.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, that is exactly what we do. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And by the way, Lynette is now a wonderful sponsor of mine. I think we're still doing that. And I don't do any sponsors, but you guys called me up the other day. I said, sure, why not? So if you guys are interested in working with Lynette and getting that white glove specialized service with your precious metals, we'll put a link in the description below.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's interesting because you would think that, you know, I don't really... When I give advice, I always talk about my 10-80-10 portfolio, and I just say, you know, 10% gold, but I don't really go into great detail. But I do say, you know, based on someone's age, maybe they can have a little more higher risk and things like that. But I probably am too nonchalant, or I'm probably too broad with the way I see just my own purchase of precious metals. I don't know.
Well, you know, you might actually want to execute the strategy yourself, or at least get it down on paper where you can take a look at it and determine, oh, well, do I have enough? Do I need more? Because it's based on all of your holdings. Now, personally, because this is a world that I've lived in on some level my entire life, I have a much higher level of comfort with the tangible market. I want it in my hands and I want it absolutely unencumbered. And even real estate, you know, you can have it paid off, but you're always going to have the property taxes because that is immovable property.
Mm-hmm.
And I say immovable property because that's the way the government and the central bank classifies it. You can't put it on your back and walk away, but you can do that with gold and silver. Physical.
What you're someone that's really done a lot of research into like the SDR and into the IMF and the World Economic Forum.
Yes.
And then you've been talking about a monetary reset for a long time. Mm-hmm. So understanding what we're dealing with now, we've got the dollar network. I always look at a fiat currency system as kind of a network, you know, because you've got lending, you've got that creates further demand for the currency in the future. And you've got, you know, businesses using it. You've got a network now of the Chinese digital yuan. I think they're starting to grow that, trying to.
Oh yeah, they are.
You've got a Bitcoin network that's trying to expand. And then you've got the IMF and the World Economic Forum that's pushing a digital SDR as the global reserve asset of choice by these global central banks. And then, of course, you've got gold and silver on the side. So with everything that's at play right now, and those specific items we just were referring to, how do you see it playing out? Like what wins and how does it look when we get to that point?
Well, I can't say exactly what's going to win, right? But we are in the thick of the battle and it's definitely heating up. And gold and silver have been in this battle for so long that they are sitting over here on the sidelines, almost unnoticeable, which is perfect, honestly.
Right.
Because you definitely can see the cryptocurrency space now under attack, you know, in China and also in the US with the new taxes coming out on it, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know who's going to win that battle. But I cannot really see central banks just handing over the power of the payment system to private entities without this huge battle.
Right.
But I still do think that the SDR is the best positioned because it's been around since 69. People don't realize that, but it's been around since 1969. And that too is fully integrated throughout the global system. I mean, you can go to the post office and in their search bar, put in SDR and you'll find it. The same thing with the airlines. So I still think the SDR ends up being the world reserve currency. And of course, it's not physical anyway, so it's going to be digital, but then everything would pass through the IMF. And when you understand that the members of the IMF are treasury secretaries and central bank chiefs, that gives them total control. And I think we can also see with the blockchain technology that the goal is to have all assets registered on blockchain. Now, you know, for governments, that gives them the ability to do lifetime taxes, which is something they've been talking about. And, you know, but it would all be controlled through the IMF. Hmm. So unless there is indeed a revolution, and we'll see, unless there is indeed a revolution, I think the IMF is the one that's going to come out running the whole show and expanding that monetary basket to include all of its members so that you then have, you know, the Fed coin. And I think they will allow, they're going to have to, because you can see how quickly Wall Street is adopting the cryptocurrencies. So, you know, if we're in that regime with all of that, with all of the ability to influence the government, I think that it will survive. I don't think it's going to survive at the levels that it's at. It can go up even higher, but, and I can even see some of the utility, but to me, that's where the speculation is. And that's also where the battle royale is taking place right now. And I feel like that battle is heating up.
Do you think if we had like a hyperinflationary type of event, let's say 50% inflation per year, and the only way to really get out of a hyperinflationary event is to instill confidence.
Correct.
In something, right? And do you think that if people lost faith in the global dollar monetary system because of the rampant inflation, that it would be solved, or that confidence would be instilled with the SDR? Maybe the question is, do you think people gravitate toward the SDR, or do you think it's imposed upon them by the central planners?
Well, okay. What we know, what history tells us, is that we're going to have on average, a currency resets before we get to that point that you're talking about 3 times. Will it be more? Will it be fewer this time? I don't know. But no, I don't think that the SDR imposed on the population is what's going to generate confidence, unless they put, and they've talked about this, they put a component of gold into the SDR, which would then stabilize the monetary system. That's why governments always go back to gold after a hyperinflationary event, mm-hmm. because that's really the only way to instill that confidence. Right. And I don't see them putting a component of, you know, the crypto space is way too volatile. It's not really going, and people still don't understand it. You know, you have to be an engineer in that space in order to fully understand it, or maybe engineers in general can. I don't know. I'm not an engineer, but I was married to one once, so a long time ago. But no, I think that's where the gold comes in. And I think that it's not going to be 100% gold back, right. But I think it'll have a percentage in there. And that's what they will use to instill the confidence, because that's what history tells us. Could this time be different? Well, of course. But is it likely to be different this time? It usually isn't. So I don't think so.
So do you think that in this kind of end game scenario, that gold goes up in real terms or just nominal terms? And I guess not even as measured by dollars, but measured by the amount of goods and services that it can purchase. You know, do you think it just purchases the same amount of goods and services or more? And if so, why more?
Well, because what a rising gold price is an indication of a failing currency. So it's kind of like you have a spring in your hand and you're holding your hand on that spring, and you can keep it there and keep it there and keep it there. But when they reset the currency, they're releasing that spring. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see gold in nominal terms go up somewhere near its fundamental value. At the same time, we know right now that real assets, other than gold and silver, are severely overvalued. Right. So everything in terms of real assets, everything goes from undervaluation to fair valuation, to overvaluation to fair valuation, to undervaluation. Okay. And it always overshoots one way or the other. It's just the way that it works. So history also tells us that this is when you will be able to expand that purchasing power. You can't really go so much by what it can buy you today versus that's just going to stay the same in the future, because the valuations are so cattywampus right now. Mm. Right. And I can tell you, on average, 25 ounces of gold would buy an entire city block, buildings and all, during this kind of reset event. Mm. 25 ounces.
But then that's assets. So I think maybe it's like kind of a 1970s type of event where gold, you would have maintained your purchasing power relative to goods and services, but you would have increased your purchasing power significantly relative to other assets, such as the S&P 500, which most people forget went down in nominal terms by 50% from 1972 to 1974. You know, if you would have held your gold during that period, even if you could have purchased the same amount of groceries in 1974, you would have been able to purchase double the amount of shares of IBM or whatever was popular back then.
IBM was. I remember my daddy sold a house and we had an IBM in Kingston. And I remember my father sold, as he had in his development, he sold this house to this nice young couple. And I remember, I don't know why this always stuck in my head, but I was standing in the doorway because they worked out of the house. And the couple had just left. And my mother bangs her fist on the table and she goes, "He's a comer. He's a comer. He makes $12,000 a year." Well, the average wage then was $9,500. So if you made $12,000 a year, you actually were quite comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was an engineer for IBM. So yeah. Just a little aside that always stuck with me. Because what happens if you make $12,000 a year now?
Exactly. Exactly. And that goes back to your point of the Fed being really the main contributor to the wealth gap, and that it's forced people to speculate from a standpoint, if you're always getting that 2% compounded inflation, And you know that incomes aren't going to keep pace with inflation. They're always going to be a bit of a lag there. The only way that you can get ahead, especially if you have these long-term bouts where real interest rates are negative, that you've got to go out there and speculate, because you can't keep your money in the bank. And then that creates this boom-bust cycle that inevitably the average Joe and Jane will be the last of the party. And absolutely, they're the ones that are going to get screwed. And then you just have this cycle of wealth destruction with the poor and the middle class over and over and over and over again. And then the next boom cycle, they all try to get in and it all comes crashing down. Yeah, if you just had that sound money.
Totally. I mean, if you went on the IMF website and you put in the search bar financial repression, you could see that that's one of their strategies. And that's exactly what you were referring to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is, you know, and so, yeah, it is the Federal Reserve. It is. And what happened back in 71 was that Nixon handed over full control of inflation to the central banks, to the Federal Reserve. Here, you take this ball. Well, we see how well that's worked. I mean, we basically have no purchasing power left in the dollar. And, you know, lately, I don't know if you've noticed this, but, you know, I mean, I listen to mainstream TV so I can understand what they're talking about and the garbage that they're selling. And I have recently heard them mention purchasing power and how, you know, well, it's going up, but the purchasing power is going down. And I just about was floored because I never hear them referring to purchasing power. And they recently started referring to it, you know, in terms of inflation, certainly. And I thought that was very telling. I mean, it tells you that we're really going to a new level on this whole thing, and including the inflation.
Yeah. Do you get uncomfortable when you find yourself agreeing with CNBC or the mainstream media?
Doesn't happen often.
That's my point.
You know, I mean, yeah, no, usually when that happens, like them talking about purchasing power, what I hear is that things have shifted. It's a shift, right? Because then, of course, in the next breath, you know, they talk out of this side of their mouth and they talk out of that side. Usually it's like, oh, let me out. I mean, if I could reach my hands through the screen and throttle them, I would absolutely do so most of the time. Yeah. But it's I use it as it. First of all, I need to know what they're telling people, what lies they're telling people, so that I can debunk it. But it also lets me know, oh, okay, they're starting to talk about purchasing power. That's pretty telling that we've gone to a new level in the whole system. And they also talk about how insane everything is. But as long as you've got interest rates on the 10-year at 1.55, well, the S&P and the NASDAQ, they should all be a lot higher.
Infinity, right.
Right.
All right. Well, Lynette, I sure appreciate your time. For my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go to check that out? We'll put a link in the description below, but outside of that.
Right. Well, they can go to itmtrading.com. They can also go to the YouTube channel where, you know, we publish all the time regularly. And they can either put in the search ITM Trading, or they can put my name, Lynette Zhang, and it'll come up. Where they can even call us, because we like human contact. 888-696-4653. What a concept. Human contact.
A telephone? What? I don't know. Maybe the viewers might not even know what that is. All right, Lynette. Well, thank you. And I can't wait to see you in Miami in a couple weeks.
I'm so excited. And are you coming back here? Maybe I shouldn't ask you this on air. Are you coming back to Phoenix?
Yeah.
Okay, then you got to come up to the cabin.
Yeah, I got to go to Belize after Miami for the Real Estate Guys Investment Conference in Belize. And then after that, I'll most likely head over to Phoenix, and I'll probably be there for a few months. So we'll definitely hang out there.
Good.
And go to your place for sure.
You've got to come to my bug out place. All right. You're going to love it. You're going to love it.
I'm sure I'll be just as blown away as the first time I saw your property in the city. I won't say exactly where it is.
Yeah, you will.
All right, Lynette, have a good one.
You too. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com. or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.